We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome back, Maria.
Thank you.
And again, we are pre-recording this at about 10:30 Saturday morning. So this is not live, but it's pretty darn close. So just for people needing that info. Okay, something happens.
So hopefully nobody will shred the Constitution in the next 3 hours. You know, no names.
Okay. Fingers crossed. So starting out with the time that this is airing at 1 o'clock, there is an event starting on Broadway and Pine.
Yeah, very large demonstration in reaction, not just to Black Lives Matter, but also now the federal stormtroopers in Seattle. And expected to be a pretty large demonstration, so we'll see what happens. But for people who are in the area, please show up. Your bodies count. So
yeah, I think it's primarily to protest the presence of federal border control agents that the Trump administration, or Donald Trump in particular, had mobilized to Seattle specifically. To protect, ostensibly to protect the federal building. I don't think the demonstration is really concentrating on Black Lives Matter, but it is definitely concentrating on that reaction to federal troops being here, even though our mayor and our police chief have not only not requested them, have said that they don't want them. So.
But we'll be returning to that subject later in the show. So
yes, we will, because Seattle's not the only city.
No, that's true.
So from there, sticking with the concept of police and their defunding, City Council and Mayor Durkan were busy this week.
Yeah, the City Council and the mayor have been in a pitched battle over whether or not the Seattle Police Department can use crowd control weapons. Now, Judge James Robart, who's been overseeing the police reform process here in Seattle, issued a ruling early this week against the city's case to overturn the city council's ban on crowd control weapons like blast balls and tear gas. The city had filed a motion to have the bill thrown out by Judge Robart because the council didn't run it by him first. But the Trump administration, of course, has intervened at the last minute. And around 9 p.m. last night, on Friday night, they won a ruling from Judge Robart to temporarily suspend that law. Now, in regards to the city's case, Robart had said...
But since people haven't heard about that necessarily, what was Robart's rationale for reversing himself in 3 days?
I'll get to that. I want to talk first about his rationale for the original ruling early in the week. In regards to the city's case, Robart said that the city hadn't made its case that the city would likely suffer irreparable harm or that they would succeed in a lawsuit against the bill. That's kind of the justification you need in order to win an injunction. Now, most notably, he cited Chief Carmen Best's own 30-day suspension on the use of tear gas, which she issued back on June 5th after about a week of the Seattle Police Department gassing the Capitol Hill neighborhood. Most notably, he cited Chief Carmen most notably, not just that suspension. So here you had the police chief clearly issuing her own suspension of a crowd control weapon, but also Judge Richard Jones' injunction against the use of crowd control weapons against peaceful protesters. Neither of those were run by Judge Robart before they were issued. Now, while the city council's ban is longer term, Robart had opted to wait for the report from the Office of Police Accountability and the Office of Inspector General for Public Safety. Those are the two oversight bodies that were set up under the police reform process, and they are both reviewing the impact of the City Council's ban. They said, and they agreed that they will submit a copy to Judge Robart by August 15th, after which the City and the Community Police Commission, that's the civilian oversight board, will have 1 week to respond. But then at the last minute, Robart on Friday night agreed with the reasoning of Trump administration lawyers who argued that this weekend's protests are an emergency that might require police to use some kind of weapon to control crowds, and that the choice was between, on the one hand, less lethal crowd control weapons like tear gas, pepper spray, blast balls, flashbang grenades, etc., and on the other hand, the choice, if those are not allowed, are guns and batons, which are obviously more lethal. Now, of course, the emergency, I need to point out here something that apparently Judge Robart did not realize, that the emergency is a manufactured one, a result of Donald Trump's worst tyrannical impulses in mobilizing an expanded federal security force against protests that have been largely peaceful. But Robart, of course, didn't see that side of it last night, instead issuing what he called a very temporary injunction to prevent the city council's ban on crowd control weapons from taking effect this weekend. In the meantime, the ban that was put in place by Judge Richard Jones will remain in force. But of course, that ban allows the Seattle Police Department to use crowd control weapons if they feel threatened, or to protect lives and property. And that's a huge loophole that they can drive a tank through. So this is going to be a...
Not only to protect... I can't hear myself. Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
We can hear you. Okay.
All right. Not only to protect property, but also, of course, they always feel threatened. So.
Yeah, they do. So, you know, it really relies on the Seattle Police Department officers' assessments of the situation. And as we've seen, as we saw in early June, when the SPD tear gassed people indiscriminately, their assessment of the situation is often flawed. So their idea of a threat to them is anyone on the street. This is going to be a big problem, I think, this weekend when we see a large crowd at 1 p.m. today protesting, 1 p.m., this is Saturday, protesting the Trump administration's mobilization of this enormously expanded security state that we've seen since 9/11 to police the streets of our cities instead of to deal with terrorists and drug cartels and so forth.
And I saw a very good interview Friday night with Tim Crowley, who's a historian at Yale University, has written about, the warning signs of fascism, basically. And he talks about how the authoritarian regimes start by being lawless at the border, and then they move that lawlessness inland to their own citizens. But it first starts with the dehumanization of others coming into the country, and then moves to dehumanization of people, in the actual country who are, labeled as
actual,
others and threats.
Citizens.
Yeah. And that's what we're seeing here. And this is all a law and order play for Trump's reelection. It is an enormous kabuki done solely for Donald Trump's benefit. And we saw this with the Central American caravans in 2018, which was a non-existent threat. Now we've got the non-existent threat of people protesting in American cities. And these stormtroopers basically have been deployed to nearly a dozen cities across the country, not just Portland and Seattle, which we'll talk about, but Chicago, Kansas City, New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and other cities that we're probably not aware of yet. This is going to be a huge issue over the next couple of weeks. And if people don't raise the alarm about this, this is creeping fascism. It really is. And it's being done to benefit one person and one reelection campaign.
Yeah. And it's clear that this is the Trump's strategy for reelection now that he can't hold a big convention and he can't do his rallies all over the country would like to do.
And he can't talk about the economy either.
No, he can't talk about the economy. That was going to be his big election issue. Look at the great economy. It's steaming full stream ahead, et cetera, et cetera. He can't talk about that. And he can't talk about conquering the coronavirus either, because that's on a downward slide as well. So this is going to be his reelection issue, is law and order in the streets. So I think at this point, if we want to make sure we don't have a man who reappoints himself president, come November, regardless of the election outcome. I think that right now we need to turn out in the streets to protest this.
Yeah, and this also is, I think, a dry run for, using his private paramilitaries, either by stationing them at the polls as a form of voter suppression, or, putting them in the streets after he claims victory for an election that he clearly lost. Those kind of things should be unthinkable in this country. But sadly, at this point, and we've certainly seen over the past 3 years, they are not. And he will do anything to stay in power. And that's the fear. The way to counter that is by turning out in the streets and making this country ungovernable if he tries that.
Yeah. Mask up and turn out.
Yeah.
And the push here in Seattle for the elimination of the use of specific less lethal weapons does not affect any of the federal troops that are being brought into the city.
Well, no, there has not been a court ruling on that. So, until it's tested in court, it doesn't affect the federal troops.
Yeah.
Per se. Although I think it could if it was taken to court.
And, Donald Trump doesn't want to talk about all those things, but later in the show we will. So,
yeah.
Time permitting.
Yes.
All right. Anything else on that? Or City Council was also busy with spending bills?
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that, too. The City Council has also been discussing defunding the police department. I want to talk about that for a minute as well. Through the end of 2020, the city council and the mayor are in that fight where the mayor says we cannot defund the police department through the end of 2020. Let's postpone it till next year. And the city council is saying, no, we need to look at it now.
As I talked about last week, Durkin's claim is, well, defunding the police by 50% means, since we're already more than halfway through the year, it means no funding for police for the rest of the year. That is clearly not what City Council is proposing. So she's being really disingenuous with that.
Yeah. The City Council's goal, of course, is is defunding the police department by 50%, but they're trying to phase that in over a number of months. Now, Mayor Durkin initially proposed cutting about $56 million that wasn't going to get spent anyway because of COVID-19 from the police department. Now she's proposing to move the 911 dispatch, the Office of Emergency Management, and the Office of Police Accountability outside of the police department and into their own budget departments. There's one big problem with that, though. The police reform process envisioned that the Office of Police Accountability would remain inside the SPD so that it could maintain access to both the data and files that they need and the personnel involved in use of force complaints. In other cities where an oversight office is outside of the police department, that office has to issue subpoenas to just get very basic information and has no access to the personnel involved. That's why during the police reform process, the folks who were arguing on the side of community groups asking for police reform particularly envisioned that the OPA would stay within the SPD and not be moved outside of it. So this would negate that. In addition, Durkin hasn't consulted either the OPA or the Community Police Commission on this change. So
there's a shock.
Or the judge. So yes, she's in violation of the reform agreement too, if you use the standard that she used to condemn the city council's ban on crowd control weapons. She has not consulted Judge Robart, and she has not consulted any of the police oversight bodies that exist through the reform process.
Not that she normally consults them anyway.
So, and secondly, Mayor Durkin and Chief Best have been exaggerating the extent of the city council's efforts to cut the police department, as you've said, Job, by first saying that would mean zero funding for the police department through the end of the year, which is not what the city council was saying. And then by saying that they'd have to lay off half the police force or close police precincts or stop responding to 911 calls. And I found this particularly disgusting. reporting, Carmen Best suggested that she would have to lay off newly hired officers of color, thereby affecting the diversity of the department. In fact, the city council is currently reviewing proposals that would phase down funding over several months, while new services are ramped up to replace some of that work that the Seattle police do that's outside of their remit, for example, providing mental health interventions. Services that even Chief Best and Mayor Durkin have agreed probably should not be done by police officers. Council member Lisa Herbold pushed back this week, saying that the mayor and police chief don't have the authority to decide some of these things. For example, the city council decides whether or not to close police precincts, not the mayor or the police chief. And the city council decides whether the police department has to lay off personnel through budget cuts, for example, not the mayor or the police chief. In addition, she pointed out that Chief Best has a responsibility to decide how layoffs happen. That's her job as the chief of police, and that Best could decide to use a formula that doesn't lay off new hires who are people of color. As for responding to 911 calls, Herbold has expressed a worry that many of us have, that Chief Best will decide to use the new crowd control weapons ban as an, or would, this was before Friday's decision, use the crowd control weapons ban as an excuse to depolice downtown and Capitol Hill in the same way that she depoliced the CHOP and the surrounding neighborhood throughout the entire month of June. That too, I should point out, is a choice that was made by Chief Best. And if she didn't make that decision, then she's not really running her department. Her department is running her, and that's a big problem.
And we should mention also that Lisa Herbold has a big say in those decisions because she is the chair of the Public Safety Committee. So yes. When she speaks, Durkin and Best have to listen.
Yes, and they haven't been, and they need to start listening to her. So with that said, so that's the tussle over the defunding the police department. The city council didn't look at that a whole lot this week. They're going to be really diving into that next week, apparently. So we'll see how that turns out this next week, and we'll talk about that next weekend. This week, the city council focused instead on two spending bills. First off, the council unanimously passed a COVID-19 relief bill that will allow the city to move $86 million out of emergency reserves to fund COVID-19 relief efforts for people and small businesses that are struggling in the city, and particularly folks who haven't benefited from any federal money. Teresa Mosqueda's Jumpstart Seattle tax on businesses with payrolls of more than $7 million will replenish that $86 million when the city starts to collect it next year. The city has two reserve funds. They have the emergency fund and the revenue stabilization fund, which is usually called the rainy day account. This bill would take the emergency fund balance down to zero and the rainy day fund down to about $42 million in reserves left over for Mayor Durkin to use for next year's budget. The money will be spent as follows, that $86 million. $32.6 million for housing programs and services to the homeless, including rental assistance programs, non-congregant shelter for the homeless, and at least four new tiny house villages. $17 million will be spent for direct financial assistance to low-income immigrants and refugees, and $1 million for language programs that serve them. $14.5 million will be for small businesses with fewer than 25 employees that haven't been able to get state or federal assistance. $13.6 million will go for the city's emergency grocery voucher program for people who are having trouble buying food right now. $3.6 million will go for childcare providers and workers who've been shuttered and laid off because of COVID-19. $2.35 million will go for nonprofit affordable housing providers who need help with ramping up personal protection, purchasing and finding supplying personal protection for their facilities. And $1.1 million will go for mortgage counseling and foreclosure prevention. So some good programs there that are being funded by those emergency funds. Now, the second bill that the council passed was to allocate the funds from the Jumpstart tax to various programs. And here's how they would spend it. In the first year, that's next year, $86 million will go back into the city's emergency funds to replenish what is being spent this year. The remainder is going to go to the following: 5% to administer and collect the tax, 75% to plug budget gaps for any services that would have to be cut because of the COVID-19 financial crisis, and any leftover amount will support programs for low-income residents, immigrants and refugees, the homeless, food programs, and small businesses. And then the final 20% would go for additional COVID-19 relief that the city is anticipating they'll need next year, too. In subsequent years, the money would be spent as follows: 5% to administer and collect the tax, 62% to build affordable housing for people making up to 30% of area median income. That's the group, that's the very, very low income group of people that are not being currently served by market, by, you know, market driven affordable housing projects. And that some of that money would include helping to pay for upgrades to existing housing to keep it available as affordable housing, which is very important. 15% of the funds from the Jumpstart tax will support local businesses and tourism to bolster the local economy post-COVID-19. 9% will support equitable development in disadvantaged communities and communities of color. And 9% will be used to implement the city's Green New Deal standards, including setting up the Green New Deal Oversight Board, job retraining for workers who are displaced by a shift to a green economy, green housing, and outreach and technical assistance programs. So that is what the Jumpstart spending bill will covers. Now, of course, Mayor Durkan came out against both of these bills, just as she came out against the Jumpstart tax. But because they passed with a veto-proof majority, she's simply decided not to sign them and let them become law anyway. Of course, Durkan is a conservative Democrat, which means she's really a moderate Republican who doesn't believe in taxes and doesn't believe that government spending actually helps anyone. She said that increasing taxes on big businesses right now might make them move elsewhere, and that this kind of bill should be passed on a county or state level, as if that would ever stop a company like Boeing or Amazon from moving to another state. We know that that is absolutely not the case. And I really am personally getting kind of tired of her lame excuses and reasons that don't make any sense.
And excuses specifically for a big business and the kind of businesses that bankrolled her election in the first place.
Oh, yeah. So that's, she's clearly serving who she perceives as her main constituency. And of course, like a Republican, she's reflexively anti-tax against any kind of change like that. And as I've said, that's a Republican position, which I think is why more local Democrats are now coming out and asking her to resign. I think a little over a week ago, three district Democratic groups sent her letters asking her to resign: the 36th District Democrats, the 37th District Democrats, and the 43rd District Democrats. And those three districts cover almost the entire city of Seattle, with the exception of the far northeast and southwest Seattle.
And I would add that, you know, a recall, online recall petition got about 40,000 signatures, and there is now a formal recall petition that's being circulated, and we'll see how that goes. It's obviously difficult to get signatures in the age of COVID, but, you know, there's a lot of support for getting Durkan out right now.
Yeah. And what I find interesting is that those three districts include some of the more conservative areas of the city, including North Capitol Hill, Ballard, Magnolia, and Queen Anne, as well as South Lake Union and downtown. And I think to have district Democratic Party members in those areas say to the mayor, look, you need to get out of there, you are not helping things, I think that's really telling. And it's a bad sign for Mayor Durkan when she goes to run for reelection next year.
And a lot is going to depend, of course, on who she's running against. So, you know, people who want to see Durkan out need to be recruiting a strong candidate who can fundraise. And that needs to be happening now.
Yeah, you need to start now, actually. And I know it's hard in the COVID-19 era, but now is a really good time because there's a lot of stuff going on and people are really paying attention and really asking themselves, you know, can't somebody do things a little bit better? You know, now's a really good time for people to start thinking about announcing and fundraising.
I would, I would also add, I am really thankful that we have the progressive city council that we have, because they're yes. they're making a real difference right now.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, speaking of elections, last week, Jav gave a summary of his thoughts on the upcoming election primary, and we wanted to give you a chance to chime in there, Maria.
And
I might revise a couple of my picks, but other than that,
that's not allowed.
Discussion is allowed. Discussion and changing your mind is always allowed if you haven't mailed your ballot yet.
Nope.
All right.
So, at the risk of repeating some stuff, I'm just going to kind of run straight through my recommendations here and ask. I'm sure Jav will have some input too. August 4th is when your ballot needs to be mailed. You should have received it in the mail by now. If not, you can call King County Elections at 206-296-VOTE. That's 206-296-8683 or VOTE. And you can also get your ballot and your voter's pamphlet in Spanish, Chinese, Vietnamese, or Korean if you prefer it, or you have a relative or friend who speaks one of those languages more fluently than English. So just let me dive in here. For the races for the U.S. House of Representatives, it's okay to vote for any of the Democratic incumbents. In District 1, that's Susan DelBene. In District 7, that's Pramila Jayapal, who's been absolutely fantastic in the U.S. House of Representatives. And in District 9, it's Adam Smith. So those are great. For governor, there are 36 candidates from all over the spectrum, including a grab bag of nutcases, and I am including Tim Iman in that description. Again, Jay Inslee, the Democratic incumbent, is the best candidate there. For lieutenant,
what I found interesting for the governor's race is that once you get past Inslee, it's anybody's guess who's going to become the second person on the ballot. Right now, Tim Iman is polling like fourth or fifth among Republicans. He's not getting much traction at all, which is good.
But, I mean, the state Republican Party isn't under any illusion that Tim Iman is a viable candidate.
Although the guy that is leading in the polls, and he's got like 13% of the overall vote, is the police chief from Republic, which is a very small town in Ferry County in eastern Washington. Uh-huh. He's getting traction because he has the gun lobby behind him.
Yeah.
And he's a gun rights guy. So that's not going to go very far in November either. But
that kind of tells you the state of the Republican Party here in Washington State.
It does. And that they think that guy is more viable than Iman is.
Yeah, exactly. Now, for lieutenant governor, again, there are 11 candidates, a lot more than we're used to seeing for an office that we often joke about. Because most people think the lieutenant governor does absolutely nothing. But there are
and they're right.
Yeah,
it's an office that really should be abolished. But
I mean, you can argue that. But there are two outstanding candidates in this race. One is Marco Lias, who's served in both the State House and Senate and who's strong on environmental and transportation issues. And Denny Heck, who's retiring from the U.S. House of Representatives. He has been representing the 10th district, that's Thurston County, including Olympia, plus Western Pierce County outside of Tacoma, which is actually a fairly large district in terms of population. Now, you might ask, why is Denny Heck retiring from the U.S. House? He has said himself that he's been demoralized by corruption in the Trump administration and having to spend most of his time working on the impeachment process. Not every good candidate, I should point out, that goes to Washington, D.C. is a real scrapper like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Pramila Jayapal. Some are consensus builders and some are doers who want to work across the aisle to get good bills passed, and that's just not happening in Washington, D.C. right now. Both of the candidates in this lieutenant governor's race have really good, pretty progressive credentials and have worked to get things done. Lias worked hard on Sound Transit 3 and clean energy bills in Olympia, and those were big last session. Denny Heck chaired the Candidate Recruitment Committee of the House Democratic Caucus campaign, and that worked to gain about 40 seats in the House so that the Democrats now have a majority in the House of Representatives. He also has experience with financial legislation and housing, affordable housing issues. So both have experience that make them really good candidates for lieutenant governor. And like I said, we joke about that office, but it can be a staging ground for a candidate to eventually run for governor. Even though I think Bob Ferguson is the natural one to run if Jay Inslee decides to retire eventually.
Yeah, and we should mention also that Dow Constantine signed off on legislation that would eventually abolish the youth jail in 2025 this week. And
I think
that
he's getting set to run for governor as well.
He was told by the people who negotiated that with him, you can be on the right side of history and run for governor in the future, or we can let Jay Inslee do it and you will never be governor.
Yeah.
And so he signed off on it. So that's the inside story there.
Yeah.
He wants to run for governor. Hillary Franz, the lands commissioner.
She's the lands commissioner, yeah.
Yeah, and she's up for re-election this year.
So there's lots of people who want to do that. Yep. But I think also a lieutenant governor can play a key role in shepherding a current governor's policies through the state legislature because, of course, he's the president of the Senate. He governs the Senate. So I think a lieutenant governor can be very, very helpful in that regard. But Denny Heck would probably be needing time to get up to speed, whereas I think Mark Elias really knows, he's more familiar with those policies, and he has a lot of current connections in Olympia. Which is why I'm leaning towards Mark Elias for this position. Heck does have one advantage with his background on financial issues, which I think are going to be very key this year and next year with the COVID-19 financial crisis. So you could go with either one of those candidates, and that would be great. I'd like to see both of them on the slate for November. I took a look at who's funding both of the, where they get their campaign contributions, and they're both pretty neck and neck in terms of getting lots of labor contributions from a lot of individuals. So they're both very good candidates. I'm leading towards Mark Elias right now, but I could go the other way as well. Now for Secretary of State, Kim Wyman is the Republican incumbent, and she keeps getting reelected in a blue state for a reason. She knows her job and has extensive training and experience with elections. She's overseen Washington State's early move to vote by mail, which has put us in a really good position when the COVID-19 crisis hit. So I think she deserves reelection. And I'm not really sure why Gail Tarleton's even running, other than to just put a Democrat on the ballot against Kim Wyman. She's currently in the state house representing District 36. That's my district, actually, Belltown, Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. Other than that, she's just a Democrat. But I think Democrats are going to have to look far and wide to find someone with Wyman's background and her experience. And I think she really deserves to be reelected. I don't know, Job, if you agree or disagree with that.
I have a mild preference for Tarleton, and she supports some registration expansion reforms that Wyman does not, but Wyman is a strong incumbent for sure. And we will mark this as maybe the first time in 20 years that you have endorsed a Republican on the air.
Yeah. The thing about Kim Wyman is I really feel like she's an old school Republican, you know, before the Republican Party became this extremist right wing, you know, fundamentalist.
And so was Sam Reed
style
before
group.
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, Republicans have held the Secretary of State position for about 40 years now, because Sam Reed had it before her. And then Ralph Monroe had it before her. So it goes this history of Republicans promoting trade and running the electoral system in Washington State and doing it in a relatively fair way goes back a long time. It really predates and has not included the current Republican tendency to use Secretary of State positions for voter suppression. That has not happened in Washington State. We're very fortunate about that.
Yeah, I think we're very fortunate of that. And I really appreciate that we are in a good position now with COVID-19 for people to be able to mark ballots at home and mail them off and be comfortable with that. She was very good at rolling it out with each of the county election departments, and they did test runs and troubleshooted it and just really worked it until it works well now. And I'm really grateful for that. And I think she deserves to be reelected for that.
And one of the minor candidates in that race is Gentry Lang, who back in the day ran as a Green Party member for on a platform of trying to prevent vote by mail. So he's kind of been on the wrong side of history there.
Yeah. Now for state treasurer, I think Jav and I agree that Mike Pelliciotti, the Democrat, would be a good choice there. For state, I'm going to just move on to state auditor. And again, I don't see a compelling need to oust the current incumbent, Pat McCarthy. She's a former Pierce County executive and a former Pierce County auditor. She has experience as an auditor. Joshua Casey is a CPA, but he has no experience running a large agency, and McCarthy does. In addition, I was looking at the campaign finance website, and Joshua Casey's campaign is financed about 50% out of his own pocket and the other 50% from individuals who all of them live outside of Washington State, which concerns me. Yeah.
It's always good to look at that website, isn't it?
Yeah. So he has zero local campaign contributions, zero from inside Washington State, aside from his own pocketbook. So that concerns me. So I support Pat McCarthy for state auditor.
Yeah,
Attorney General. And then my favorite office in this election, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who keeps filing lawsuits and winning them against the Trump administration, definitely deserves your support. So don't stop him now.
Yeah. We'll need him for going forward for sure.
We are going to need him. Yeah.
And it hasn't just been the Trump administration. He's also taken on a lot of large corporations on behalf of consumers, Comcast being the most notable example. He's been really, really aggressive in the AG's office, and aggressive in a good way.
Yes.
So keep him there.
So keep him there. Yes. And
until he runs for governor.
Yes. And then for Commissioner of Public Lands, again, Hillary Franz has been doing just fine in that job. And there's no one opposing her that I would support above her.
I mentioned this last week. She's been the first person in that office, really, who's come from an environmental perspective. And that's hugely important when managing the state's public lands.
Yeah. And I think she's been doing a very good job at that. For superintendent of public instruction, I would have to say the same for Chris Reichdahl. That's a difficult job to do in a state where we're tussling over funding for public schools and whether or not charter schools should have a portion of that funding. And I think Chris Reichdahl has been doing a good job apprising state legislators of the state of public schools and kind of keeping them going. I don't know how you feel about this election for superintendent of public schools.
Exactly the same.
Okay. Now, for insurance commissioner, I feel the same way I do, almost the same way I do about Bob Ferguson. If we could keep Mike Kreidler going in this office forever, we should.
I totally agree.
Maybe getting
past re-election runs, his opponents are all funded by the health insurance industry, which tells you a lot.
Yeah, and he's been doing the best job that he can, I think, keeping them honest. Now, for Washington State Legislature,
I don't know if keeping is the right verb there, but yeah.
Yes. For the Washington State Legislature, there are lots of unopposed incumbents up for reelection, and I'm not going to talk about them, but there are a few contested, and there are, you know, a lot of incumbents, Democratic incumbents in those races who have only a single Republican running against them. So you know who I would support already. I'm not going to talk about those races either. But there are a few contested races. And I have to say, it's nice to see this year a slate of candidates representing the concerns of people of color, including issues like income inequality, gun violence, housing affordability, police reform, and institutional racism. And I'll be talking about a few of those. in District 11, House Position 1, District 11 is much of southeast Seattle from Beacon Hill to Georgetown and parts of Canton Renton. Zach Hudgens is the incumbent Democrat, but I like activist David Hackney, who has served on the Washington State Human Rights Commission and the board of the Alliance for Gun Responsibility. He has also explicitly come out in favor of a state income tax versus Hudgens' support for a capital gains tax and very vague promises of a more progressive tax system in Washington state. Hudgens has also received campaign contributions from a number of lobbying groups and corporations like CenturyLink, Boeing, Walmart, Primera Blue Cross, Pemco Insurance, BNSF Railway Company, AT&T, and the Washington Technology Industry Association. So David Hackney's campaign contributions are all individuals and tend to be smaller donations. So I support David Hackney for District 11, House Position 1. And I think that might be opposite of what you recommended last week, Jav.
Well, yeah, I think Hudgens has done some good things over the years.
Yeah.
I would like to see the two of them in the general. I'd like to see the challenger have a chance to raise a bit more money. Hudgens has a lot more money at this point.
Yes,
and I'd like to see the campaign become viable and those two go at it.
Yeah, and David Hackney, I think, too, is also part of that slate I mentioned of candidates who are have connections to their to the communities that they're running in and are paying good attention to the concerns of people of color. Now, District 30, House Position 1, that's in down in Federal Way, of the two Democrats in this race, I feel that Jamila Taylor is part of that slate of candidates and has more knowledge of the issues that matter in that district. So that's who I'm recommending for District 30. District 32, House Position 1, that's Linwood, Edmonds, and Shoreline. Cindy Ryu is the incumbent. And she's a safe choice, but Shirley Sutton
she's a very, very corporate Democrat.
Yeah, Shirley Sutton is the more progressive one on the issues, and she would be a great choice. Ryu's corporate backers include the Washington State Auto Dealers, Vulcan Inc., Puget Sound Energy, the Washington Association of Realtors, and a whole host of insurance companies and their PACs. Interestingly, Cindy Ryu doesn't sit on any healthcare-related committees, but she has her bachelor's degree in microbiology from the UW, so she may be a sympathetic ear for the insurance industry lobby. And she sits on the consumer protection and business committees. And given that insurance companies are a big source of consumer complaints made to the Attorney General's office, you can see why they would want someone like Cindy Ryu in their back pocket. So in that race, vote for Shirley Sutton.
Yep, agreed.
Now, District 32, House Position 2, that's the same district, Linwood, Edmonds, and Shoreline. Former Gates Foundation employee Lauren Davis is still casting around for an office to hold. I think the much better and more progressive candidate in this race is Gray Peterson, even though he hasn't collected many campaign contributions. Now, he's served on the executive board of the Snohomish County Democrats and worked with Equal Rights Washington, Washington United for Marriage, and other progressive organizations. And like Cindy Ryu, Lauren Davis's campaign contributors include a who's who of insurance companies and, in her case, healthcare corporations like Gilead Sciences, Caremark, Johnson & Johnson, and a couple of very large doctors' PACs. Davis was the first executive director of the Washington Recovery Alliance and has extensive experience on mental health and recovery issues. I think the fact that she's now taking big money from healthcare corporations is not encouraging in her case. So I would support Gray Peterson. And if you have some spare change or some money that you can put towards a political campaign, I would give donations to Gray Peterson and to Shirley Sutton to help them overcome their race against these two very corporate supported Democratic candidates.
And the 32nd is an interesting district because they've been at war for oh gosh, at least a quarter century, the schism between the progressive wing of the party in that district and the corporate wing. And the corporate wing ousted Marilyn Chase a couple years ago from the state Senate. And they're ascendant right now. And that district needs a progressive representative, ideally two.
Yeah, ideally two. Now, District 36, House Position 2, I think you may have left that district out when you were doing your recommendations last week, Job. That's my district, Belltown, Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. There are three Democrats running for this seat in an overwhelmingly white and affluent district, and two candidates stand out. One is Liz Berry for her work as president of the National Women's Political Caucus of Washington State. And she's garnered a lot of endorsements, including Pramila Jayapal, Lorena Gonzalez, and Teresa Mosqueda. But I'm actually leaning towards Sarah Reinfeld. That's the managing assistant attorney general in Bob Ferguson's office. They're both very, very good candidates. When I looked at their campaign contributions, they both have contributions from individuals and a lot of individuals and not many businesses, mostly from labor unions. And they're both very good candidates. But Liz Berry, a lot of her campaign contributions are from out of state, just showing that she hasn't lived in Washington for as long as Sarah Reinfeld. And I really like the work that Sarah Reinfeld's been doing along with Bob Ferguson in the Washington State Attorney General's office. So I am supporting Sarah Reinfeld in my District 36 for House Position 2. In District 37, that's downtown Seattle, Capitol Hill, and Southeast Seattle.
That's my district.
Renton, that's your district. Definitely, you want to reelect Sharon Tamiko Santos for House Position 1. And in the Position 2 race, I support former Seattle City Council member Kirsten Harris Talley as progressive choice with some experience already, having been temporarily on the Seattle City Council. I think she would be a very, very good choice for that.
Yeah, thought she did a really good job in her time as interim city council member, and I think she'd be outstanding. And again, is part of that wave of people who look like and represent their district that you were talking about.
Yeah, and have good connections, good progressive connections within their own district. Now, District 43, Position 2, that's the University District, Wallingford, Fremont, Finney Ridge, and South Green Lake area. Frank Chopp is running for re-election. He recently retired as House Speaker in the Washington State Legislature, but obviously has not retired from his position, from his House seat yet, and is now running for re-election. I think the much better candidate is activist and progressive community organizer Sheree LaSalle's. She doesn't have a whole lot of funding. So again, if you have some extra money that you want to put towards political campaigns this year, Sheree LaSalle's would be a good person to support in that District 43 Position 2.
My concern with her is she doesn't have a lot of relevant experience, but Frank Chopp has been so bad and so out of step with his district for so many years that he needs to be retired.
You could argue that Frank Chopp has too much experience as a corporate Democrat.
You could argue that, yes.
Some fresh faces in there. So, and all she's right. Very, very much in that slate of candidates with connections to, with good progressive connections to their district, and is a person of color, and I think would be very, very good on progressive issues in the state legislature.
Okay, does that wrap it all up?
Yeah, that does.
All right, then let's.
So we have what, 15 minutes to talk about the world going to hell?
About the rest of the world.
Well, we wanted to bounce back to Portland and other cities that are currently being visited by federal troops.
Yeah, Portland has been a mess all week. And of course, the presence of federal troops there, widely reported first, not just defending the federal building in Portland, but also going arresting people far away from any federal property and doing it in plainclothes people in unmarked vans, literally kidnapping them, whisking them back to the basement of the federal building and questioning them there and then releasing them. It's really, really scary stuff and the kind of thing that you see in, a third world thugocracy, not supposedly in a democratic country. That has made the protests larger, more militant, and much more visible in terms of national media. And it's also inspiring people in other cities. We saw the first Wall of Moms in Chicago yesterday, for example. There's also a Wall of Vets. There's also dads showing up and granddads showing up with leaf blowers to blow the tear gas back. Last night, the federal troops had their own leaf blowers. So it's a war of leaf blowers. but it really has been a spectacle, and it's gone late into the night every night this week. I was up until 5 a.m. watching it Thursday night, and the federal tactics continue to escalate, which is the worrisome part, because you wonder how long it's going to be before they start using live ammunition.
The thing is they don't understand that there are people out there with their cell phones live streaming this stuff. So anybody sitting at home, any mom and dad, grandparent, whatever, is on Facebook watching their grandkid or their sons or daughters out there facing off with against federal troops.
Yeah,
in real time.
And you have a wall of veterans. You had an Air Force veteran who got beat up by federal troops earlier this week.
Yeah,
that was captured on Facebook. Yes. All of the social media. Twitch had 18 different live streams from Portland last night. I mean, this is really going out to a very large audience that is not in Portland, or who is in Portland but can't attend for whatever reason.
I find interesting is that we didn't have this back during the WTO protests, but we have this now, this live streaming on Facebook.
We didn't have it in Occupy 8 years ago.
I know. It's amazing.
It's really amazing.
And it really is one way in which I think this is really coming back to bite the Trump administration in the behind, is that they think they can do this deployment of federal troops and do this whole law and order thing, and we're going to get control of the inner cities, when in fact what's happening is people are seeing repression live in real time on Facebook, and it's bringing more people out into the streets.
Absolutely.
And it really should. It really should.
Yeah, including in Seattle. So
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 1 o'clock, Broadway and Pine. Be there. Or if you're not there yet, go there.
Yes.
And we should mention also, I mean, it's not just Seattle and Portland. It's also, as I said, Albuquerque, Kansas City, Chicago, Baltimore, New York, Philadelphia. These are all cities that Donald Trump has made a point of pointing out. He's sending them to Democrat cities, and he's trying to do an us against them that's very specific to electoral politics and to his chances for re-election. This is an arm of his re-election campaign, and it needs to be opposed as such. And as something that's, you know, flagrantly in violation of the all sorts of things in the Constitution.
All right, let's talk quickly about the Republicans in D.C., fighting the COVID-19 relief bill, and then do a wrap-up
and each other.
What's happening. Yes, and then a wrap-up of COVID-19 for you got 7 minutes.
Yeah, okay, so the Republicans have been fighting each other over COVID-19 relief bill. The expanded $600 unemployment benefits will be ending this coming Friday at a time when we've had record people filing for unemployment.
And as of last night, the provision that prevents a moratorium on rental evictions has also expired.
Yeah.
So you've got those at the same time. And estimates are that up to 28 million people could lose their housing over that.
Yeah. Now here in Washington State, both our governor and our city council have extended the moratorium on evictions, but that's not the case federally. Now, Democrats in Congress, they want to pass a new relief bill that would provide $3 trillion in relief funds for small businesses.
And they passed that in the House 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans have had
really
2 months to work this out, and they've been unable
in the Senate. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would provide relief for state and municipal governments that need help in supplying hospitals and ramping, and most importantly, ramping up testing and contact tracing. But the Republicans can't get Donald Trump to agree on what they want to include in their stripped down $1 trillion bill that they want to pass in the Senate. The fight is over $25 billion for states to conduct testing and contact tracing. The Trump administration wants to eliminate that. They want to eliminate $10 billion for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, $15 billion for the National Institutes of Health, $20 billion for the Pentagon so it can help states deal with the outbreak and help distribute a vaccine, and $2 billion for the Indian Health Services to treat Native communities decimated by COVID-19.
I have a theory, by the way, that somebody told the Trump campaign that COVID was disproportionately striking communities of color,
and they decided that's
a fine form of permanent voter suppression. It really is terrifying, but the Trump administration appears eager, actually, for the pandemic to spread and continue. They're doing absolutely nothing to slow it down.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Now, Donald Trump himself proposed, instead of doing all that, to do a payroll tax cut, which is deeply stupid, given that people thrown out of work by COVID-19 would get zero help from a payroll tax cut. Now, in addition, Trump proposed that the bill include money to build a new FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. on a site near his Washington, D.C. hotel. That's an egregious instance of self-dealing, since that property would otherwise be sold to a company that would build a competing hotel. Trump has also proposed that any money in the package.
And he tried to move the FBI earlier in order for that hotel to move in, and he nixed that deal, which was also deeply corrupt.
Yeah. Now, Trump also proposed that any money in the package for schools be conditioned on those schools fully opening this fall, and any that opt instead to do remote learning would get zero money from the package. While Democrats want a fully funded extension of the expanded $600 unemployment benefit checks, the Republicans have proposed scaling that program back to provide just $200 extra.
And we don't have time to get into it. We'll talk about it next week. But the opening of schools cannot happen safely anywhere, period, end of story.
And anybody who thinks that their kids are going to be going to school this fall, you're really kidding yourself, I think. Now, the far right extremists in the House and Senate are also arguing that the federal government should not pass another spending bill at all. Their alternative has been to just reopen the economy faster and, damn anybody who dies of COVID-19. I guess you're right, Job, in their eyes. If it's people of color, that's great. So, and as I said, this comes as the unemployment rate has spiked again after going down slightly in July when southern states rushed to reopen. Now those southern states are seeing a huge surge in COVID-19 cases.
And we have now 18 straight weeks of more than a million people being filing for unemployment benefits. That tells you the state of the economy right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And COVID-19 infections are also up, with over, 1,000 people a day dying. So,
yeah, and 78,000 people yesterday, which was a new record, and we're pushing now for 1/3 of the global cases. It's really, really bad, and I could go on at length, but I won't because we don't have time.
Okay, how about events?
Oh, we got events. Yeah, starting, as we mentioned a couple times, with the rally going on now at Capitol Hill, Broadway and Pine. Also at 1 o'clock, starting at 1 o'clock, so you might have time to get there, a Black Immigrant and Refugee Solidarity rally that met at the Tukwila Village Community Development Association on Tukwila International Boulevard. They are marching to 3037 South 160th Street. So down in the south end, if you're down that way and can find them, go for it. Every evening, probably throughout the week, the Women's March for Black Lives Matter continues. At 10 a.m.
Where do they usually convene?
They usually convene at Broadway and Pine,
yeah,
and then go down to the West Precinct and around.
I think the route changes from time to time, so
yeah,
it's good to get there early enough so that you can join them at the beginning.
Yep. Each Sunday morning, there is a silent protest during the Ballard Farmers Market for 50% defunding of police. That's from 10 a.m. on at the 5400 block of Ballard Avenue. On Monday, August the 3rd, will be the final council vote on budget changes for 2020, and that will be passed out of committee, I think, next Wednesday. Also, if you want to go to that or make yourselves heard, because they're all meeting online, and you can sign up online as well. And then Tuesday, August 4th is the deadline for getting your ballots mailed for the primary. So mark them the way Maria told you to and send them in.
Yes, and mail them a few days early, because Postal Service has been a little slow with all the packages going through the mail because of COVID-19. So get your ballot marked and mailed early.
Yep. So, and because Donald Trump is trying to destroy the Postal Service, but that's a different story.
Yes.
I think they're all intimately intertwined.
Yeah, they are. It's all one story. We just spend a lot of time, you know, making the connections.